Hello, this is Sheila Lammers with the Vermilion County News, dated Wednesday, March 8, 2017. We'll begin today's reading with an article from the Champaign-Urbana News-Gazette called "Danville Fire Department: Mayor Proposes 16 Layoffs." Mayor Scott Eisenhower proposed laying off 16 firefighters at a Tuesday night budget meeting as a result of a contract arbitration decision. Eisenhower, who described the cuts as a harsh plan, proposed reducing fire department personnel from 42 to 26 after learning earlier in the day that the city lost an arbitration decision on the firefighters' contract regarding minimum manning and salaries. Currently, according to the contract with the fire department, there must be 13 firefighters on duty per shift. The city wants to reduce that number to 10 per shift. Officials said that would have allowed the city, gradually, through attrition, to reduce the overall number of firefighters and achieve long-term personnel cost savings, including reducing pension costs that have soared in the last decade. It prompted the city to create a public safety fee charged to every residence and business to meet those expenses. But the arbitrator's decision delivered Tuesday morning favored the firefighters' positions for a four-year contract with annual salary increases of 2%, 2%, 3%, and 2%. The city wanted only a three-year contract and for retaining minimum manning at 13 per shift. At Tuesday night's budget planning session with city aldermen, Eisenhower said the arbitrator's decision adds another $1.3 million to the city's proposed expenses for next fiscal year, and then proposed that the only way to control costs in the fire department is to lay off 16 firefighters. He said the city would still meet minimum manning requirements with only 26 firefighters by utilizing overtime, which would cost about $1.5 million a year. There would be an additional $480,000 in unemployment costs the first year because of the layoffs. But Eisenhower maintained that this new plan would still result in long-term cost savings to the city, which already has $800,000 in firefighter overtime costs this year because of minimum manning requirements with its current roster of 43 firefighters. The proposal sparked a long discussion among the mayor and aldermen that at times became heated. Alderman Sharon Pickering, Mike O'Kane, and Ricky Williams Jr. questioned various aspects of the plan to cut that many firefighters, while Alderman Steve Foster supported it. Williams asked if 26 total firefighters would be enough to keep the department safe at fire scenes, as well as their overall mission of protecting the city from fires. Pickering questioned whether the overtime and unemployment costs would really be more economical than employing enough firefighters to reduce overtime. O'Kane told the mayor he wants to know how much firefighters would actually be working under those conditions and whether it would be legal. Our next article is from the Commercial News and is called "Suspect Mistakenly Chased After Wrong Car." An alleged drunken driver who struck multiple vehicles Monday morning mistakenly chased after a car in which he thought his girlfriend was riding. Danville Police Criminal Investigations Commander Josh Webb said the follow-up investigation into the incident confirmed Alfred P. Smith III, 27, mistakenly identified his girlfriend as being in a vehicle he later rammed. Smith believed his girlfriend was in the vehicle with another man, chased the vehicle, and eventually ran the vehicle off the road, Webb said. When he saw the occupants step out, he realized he did not know them. After ramming about three vehicles around 8:20 a.m. Monday at Jackson and Voorhees Streets, Smith was taken into custody near Vermilion and Woodlawn Streets. He had two outstanding warrants and was charged with aggravated battery with vehicle, criminal damage to property, and driving under the influence of alcohol. Webb added all charges filed against Smith from Monday's incident will stand. Now we have our high school confidential report in the News Gazette, and we'll begin with the report from Westville High School by Bailey Langster. The band and chorus performed at the annual winter concert Sunday. Also, students and teachers are taking part in Dodge for a Cause, forming dodgeball teams for a night of competition that will raise money for homeless veterans in Vermilion County. From Oakwood High School, student Brooke Mercer wrote this. Juniors Kelsey Blackford, Lane Warren, Brenna Durst, Garrett Lashway, Emily Simonich, Ashley Joy Webb, Aaron Wright, and Evan Young were inducted into the National Honor Society. Brandon Rowe was named Student of the Month. Lucas Hoshauer earned Athlete of the Month. Caitlin Blankenship received Character Trait for Leadership. And Darcy Nicolny was named Staff Member of the Month. From Georgetown Ridge Farm High School, student Mary Key submitted a picture that says students and staff showed their school pride by wearing purple and gold on Friday. From Bismarck Henning High School, student Gina Russell wrote, "This year's school play, Alice at Wonderland, was about a modern-day Alice whose cell phone was sucked down a rabbit hole. The play was directed by school secretary Rochelle Edwards and English teacher Jeff Buchelman. Junior Morgan Klett played Alice." From Armstrong High School, this is our submission. "For the first time in school history, the Scholastic Bowl team won the county tournament. The Nerd Herd went 6-0. Bryce Dillman, Kyle Reitmeyer, and Tyler Kane were named to the all-county team. Kane, who was named to the all-conference team for the fourth year in a row, said, "We all played our best, and I couldn't be happier with the outcome. It was exciting to finally part with our Red Sea of second-place plaques." And now we have an article from the Commercial News called "No More Hunger. DAC Supports Students with Food Pantry." Canned goods, ready-to-eat meals, and personal care items filled the tall shelving units inside a storage room at Danville Area Community College. Those basic necessities benefit more than a dozen DAC students each month who are at 150% of poverty level. On the first Friday of every month, blue totes are placed in the Mary Miller Building, Lincoln Hall, Clock Tower, and Technology Center to collect non-perishable food items and personal hygiene items that are donated by faculty, staff, and students. Donations also may be brought anytime to room 209 of Vermilion Hall. The DAC Foundation took over being in charge of Food Pantry Friday and stocking the student food pantry in January 2016 after the DAC employee who started the initiative in 2012 left. The food pantry was launched after faculty and staff recognized there were students who were hungry and they wanted to do something to support them. The foundation's executive director, Tracy Walfelt, said, "I can't imagine being hungry and going to school and trying to concentrate," she said. Since that time, the pantry has helped 50 DAC students and 167 of their family members, Walfelt said. There are non-perishable food items, personal care items such as shampoo and deodorant, paper towels, toilet paper, and even diapers, she said. These are things necessary for living, but that students might not be able to afford. Bulk items such as paper towels, toilet paper, and diapers are distributed in smaller amounts to help tide over the students who need them, but also to have items left to help other students. In addition to non-perishable food and personal care items, the foundation also accepts monetary donations to purchase food items, as well as gift cards for stores such as Ruler Foods, County Market, and Meijer that can be given to students to purchase fresh produce and meat. To make a monetary donation online to the foundation for the food pantry, donors may go to www.dacc.edu and click on Give at the top, which leads to the DAC Foundation's page. It allows you to write in to use the money for the food pantry, Walfelt said. We can purchase food through the Eastern Illinois Food Bank at a greatly reduced price, she said, giving as an example a box of cereal for 17 cents. Walfelt said the food pantry's greatest need is ready-to-eat meals. Sometimes students are hungry today and need something to eat now, or some of our students are homeless and don't have a way to cook something, she said. DAC faculty and staff identify the students who they think would benefit from the food pantry, located on the second floor of Vermilion Hall, and refer them there, but also students come to the food pantry on their own after seeing information about it on flyers posted on campus and in student email. There's a form they fill out that states they are at 150% of poverty level, Walfelt said. They self-certify. Students who come to the food pantry also receive information about other agencies and resources in the community that could benefit them, she said. We've been lucky that people have stepped up and supported it with monthly donations, she said of the food pantry. The students have stepped up as well as with student-led food drives. Some of the items that are needed include peanut butter, canned meats, pasta, spaghetti sauce, canned fruits and vegetables, ramen noodles, cereal, soup, shampoo, soap, deodorant, female hygiene supplies, toothpaste, toothbrushes, hand lotion, dish soap, laundry detergent, and diapers. We'll turn now to Vermilion County first for additional local news. Here there's an article called Danville Council Raises Some Nuisance Penalties. Danville City Council members have agreed to raise penalties for certain offenses regarding motor vehicles, but aldermen have decided to delay raising penalties for inoperable and abandoned vehicles. The council agreed during its regular meeting Tuesday night to raise the administrative fee for first-time offenses from $300 to $500 and second and any subsequent offense from $500 to $750. City Council members decided they wanted more time to discuss possibly raising those penalties for inoperable and abandoned vehicles. The higher administrative fees that were approved apply to such violations as fleeing or eluding police, violating the Illinois Controlled Substances Act, and committing acts of vandalism or criminal damage. The higher administrative fees are in addition to any penalties imposed by other city ordinances or state law. Also during their meeting, Danville City Council members approved a 3-year contract with Comcast. It will provide the city with a new dedicated fiber internet connection and fiber Ethernet services. We also have an article here that was probably released yesterday called Popular Nightclub Now Just a Memory. A once popular nightclub south of Danville is now just a memory. Construction crews on Monday demolished the former Lamplighter building located at the intersection of Illinois Route 1 and East 14th Street in Tilton. The building has been vacant for years but once was a very popular night spot. Performers such as Freddie and the Freeloaders, along with Mickey Gilley, were just some of those who entertained crowds there. The building had also been a steakhouse and lounge in recent years. A few former patrons drove by Monday to watch as heavy equipment tore into the building. Others went on social media posting comments about memories of good times there. Although the site is located just off Interstate 74 and has easy access, there have been no plans announced for future use of the space. Our next article here is called Illinois Second Highest State in Property Taxes. Illinoisans' property tax rates are higher than all but one other state. Finance website WalletHub's annual property tax rankings show Illinoisans still pay a higher burden than any other state except New Jersey. The average person in Illinois is spending around $4,000 each year in property taxes just to have their house, said WalletHub analyst Jill Gonzalez, who added low-tax neighbors like Indiana make moving across the border an attractive option. 1.5 percentage points off your property tax rate certainly is worth it, depending on what type of family is moving across these lines. The average amount Illinois homeowners pay in property taxes is more than 2 times the national average. Gonzalez said the expectation in high-tax states is that their services are among the best in the nation. Illinois is an outlier in this as well. Despite near nationwide high property taxes, a report from U.S. News & World Report ranks Illinois as only 20th in quality of education and 47th in overall government services. Gonzalez said a property tax freeze becomes a boon to residents looking for relief from rising taxes. It helps people to stay in the state rather than hop the border, she said. But Gonzalez says the proposed property tax freeze in Illinois' grand bargain would not affect the majority of Illinoisans, since it wouldn't apply to larger cities with home rule status, meaning most cities with at least 25,000 people. While the rural municipalities might see this tax freeze program, the larger cities will not, she said. Proponents of high property taxes to pay for education say it provides for a stable source of revenue and is much less susceptible to swings in the economy. The downside of relying on property taxes for much of the state's education expenses is the hit to home values and the ripple effect it has on the local economy. When potential buyers are looking at homes, they consider the total cost of the monthly mortgage payment, not just the home cost. Higher property taxes mean they can't afford nearly as much of a house payment. Illinoisans have to settle for lower selling prices just to get out from under their houses. Housing experts say this also has a cooling effect on home sales and depresses overall home values. The slowing of turnover in home purchases, in turn, slows down the entire local construction industry, which, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is Illinois' highest-paying employment sector. And now I have one event announcement from Vermilion County First. On March 12th, from 7 p.m. through March 13th at 8 p.m., let's look and see what this means. Red Mask Players announces auditions for the spring children's production, The Mysterious Case of the Missing Ring, at Catherine Randolph's Theater, 601 North Vermilion Street. Scripts are available for in-library reading at the Danville, Oakwood, and Westville Public Libraries. Children in grades 3 through 8 are eligible to audition. Show dates are May 15th through 21st. For additional information, please visit the website redmaskplayers.com. And I would certainly advise that since the times and dates are not quite clear on March 12th and 13th, probably from 7 to 8 p.m. both of those days. Now we'll go back to the commercial news for an editorial released an hour ago called Right to Worship Threatened. For a nation founded on the principle of freedom of religion, some Americans can't seem to tolerate those who are different from themselves. White House officials spoke out Tuesday against a series of bomb threats made to Jewish institutions across the country, according to the Associated Press. There have been more than 120 such threats made since January 9th, and five in New York City on Tuesday alone. Also, four mosques in Atlanta recently received threats, according to CNN. The Council on Islamic Relations said the threats were part of a mass mailing sent to mosques across the country. At the top of this page, the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution makes the intent of the Founding Fathers clear. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Those who wrote the Constitution had seen the effects of state-sanctioned religion, and they wanted no part of it. The pilgrims came to North America so they could worship as they pleased. President George Washington made it a point during his tenure to worship in houses of several religions, including a mosque. There's nothing patriotic or brave or noble about threatening anyone about the way he or she worships. That choice is a personal one, and it should be respected. No one should be compelled to follow a particular religion, no matter what it might be. The White House has set the right tone on this issue by condemning such threats. We hope federal officials also apply the full force of the law against those found guilty of such actions so that worshipers may gather as they please. It is the American thing to do. And it's time now for our local obituaries, and we'll begin with those in the News Gazette. Christina M. Landers, 58, of Danville, passed away at 9:13 p.m. Monday, March 6th, at her home. A celebration of life service will be held at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, on Saturday, March 11th, at Sunset Funeral Home, Covington Chapel, 420 3rd Street in Covington, Indiana. Alex Davolt will officiate. Cremation rites will be accorded following services, and interment will be at a later date. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, Saturday, March 11th, at the funeral home in Covington. Memorials may be made to the American Cancer Society or Carl Hospice. Sharon Lynn Childress Mildenberger, 63, of Fithian, daughter of Frank and Imogene Cannell Childress, passed away peacefully at home on Tuesday, March 7th, surrounded by her loved ones. A visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 9th, at Pape Family Funeral Home at 10 East William Street in Danville. Services will be at 10 a.m. Friday, March 10th, at Pape's, with Pastor Rod Godley officiating. Burial will follow in the O'Brien Family Cemetery in Sadorus. And now we'll turn to the commercial news for additional obituaries. Emma L. Green, 76, of Danville, went home to be with her Lord and Savior early morning Saturday, March 4th. A celebration of Emma's life will be at 11 a.m. Friday, March 10th at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center at 3940 North Vermilion Street in Danville. Officiating will be Pastor Alan Rudy. A visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday at the funeral home. Burial will follow at Danville National Cemetery. And now we'll carry on with local news. Our article is called "Some Casino Operators Oppose Expanding Gaming," and it's from Vermilion County First. Managers of the Jumers Casino in Rock Island are opposed to adding more casinos in Illinois, including one in Danville. Jumers spokesman Bill Rink says any new casinos in the state would likely merely poach players from existing casinos. And Rend adds the legislation being considered to add more casinos is coming at a time when more and more people in the state are choosing video poker over a trip to the casino. Operators of the casino in Rock Island say they already have enough competition, and they worry how the plan to add six more casinos in the state might impact their operation. A bill that cleared the Illinois Senate last week proposes allowing six new casinos, including ones in Danville, Chicago, Rockford, Lake County, the South Suburbs, and in Williamson County in southern Illinois. But the bill is part of a grand bargain with a dozen other bills, and there was a side agreement that if all parts of the grand bargain failed to win approval, none of them would advance, and one of the bills regarding pension reforms failed to muster enough support. Illinois lawmakers are meeting today and could revive the efforts to reach agreement on a new budget deal. That concludes our local news for today, so we have a little time to read one of Bruce Kaufman's history lessons. This one is called "Our Constitution and Trading in Slaves." The Founding Fathers are often called demigods, mostly because of the document they produced and signed on September 17th in 1787, the U.S. Constitution. But there is a reason for the demi. They were far from perfect, as evidenced by two shameful provisions in this Constitution: the Fugitive Slave Clause, which forced northern states to return runaway slaves to their owners in southern states, and Article 1, Section 9, Paragraph 1, which extended for 8 years, until 1808, the time period in which Congress was forbidden to interfere with the slave trade. I have written before of the embarrassment our Founding Fathers must have felt in protecting slavery in this sacred document, even using the euphemism "persons" to describe slaves so that they could keep the word slavery out of the Constitution while keeping the institution of slavery in it. But the language protecting the importation of slaves until 1808, which meant importing an additional 40,000 slaves into America, is an even more astonishing example of euphemism and obfuscation. Here the founders' embarrassment knew no bounds. The passage reads, "The migration or importation of such persons, slaves, as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit, shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. Does anyone think that even one of those 40,000 slaves migrated to America? Were they like certain birds who, not liking the hot weather in Africa, decided to migrate to the milder temperatures in the slave states of America's South? Further, is it not curious that the founders made the claim that, when they thought it proper, they were admitting these slaves into their country, as if 40,000 Africans would petition to be led into America so that they could be chained, whipped, and worked to death? And which slaves did the founders think they were not proper to admit, other than those who were old, infirm, or near death, thanks to the horrifying conditions they endured in the slave ships that carried them across the ocean to America? There is not a more shameful passage in the Constitution, but there is one irony: the inclusion of the seemingly innocuous phrase, "as any of the states now existing." That suggested that the founders meant to protect slavery only in those states that existed when the Constitution was signed. Abe Lincoln would point to that language as proof that the founders never intended for slavery to spread to the new territories, later the new states, that would enter the Union. Disagreement on that very point was the main cause of the Civil War, a war that ended slavery forever and everywhere in America. Next, we'll read an advice column from Jan Blackstone, the founder of BonusFamilies.com, and this is the Ex-Etiquette piece, entitled "Kids Put in Unfair Position." Question is, I've been going through a divorce for 4 years. There's a lot of financial stuff, and my ex is dragging his feet, so I've moved on to another relationship. My ex is demanding that my children not be around my boyfriend. I want to cooperate, but he moved in with me 6 months ago. I didn't tell my ex because he is so jealous and has a terrible temper. The kids live with us half the time, and we are all happy. Now that my ex has found out, his request seems ridiculous. What's good ex etiquette? And the answer is, honoring an ex's request, if possible, is always the best ex etiquette, but asking for the next to impossible doesn't make it easy. There's no law that controls with whom you live. And as much as exes feel they can dictate their ex's behavior, they really can't. Of course, the ideal situation would be to have a final divorce decree prior to moving on, but you say the time component made that difficult. Demanding now that the children not associate with your boyfriend seems impossible, especially if you have lived together for 6 months. That said, parents have a right to know with whom their children live. You should have informed Dad prior to your boyfriend moving in. It sounds like you didn't because you were afraid of Dad's reaction. That doesn't matter. Good ex etiquette for parents, rule number 8, is be honest and straightforward. Not telling Dad put your kids right in the middle and force them to lie to their dad for the last 6 months. It wasn't fair to put them in that position, and it undermined him. If he has a bad temper, the children will shy away from him all by themselves. It's not good ex etiquette to help it along by lying to your ex and asking your children to support the lie. When children go back and forth between their parents' homes, they must be able to freely discuss their time at each home. If you are telling your children not to discuss what goes on in your home, you are asking them not to discuss half their life. Think about that. It's not fair to anyone. This is when exes start talking about privacy. Everyone wants privacy. Truth is, if you are sharing the kids equally and doing it right, there will be very little privacy. And if your 4-year-old comes home with horrible stories about mommy or daddy, check with mommy or daddy before calling an attorney or child protective services. Odds are they are telling you a story through a child's eyes or a teenager's eyes. Both can be questionable. Finally, there are degrees of bad tempers. If your children are in danger of physical abuse, that is when you call Child Protective Services. Otherwise, divorced parents have an obligation to support each other's efforts in successfully co-parenting their children. And finally, we have a question and answer in the Dear Abby column. The question is, Abby, it was brought to my attention that an employee in my workplace was asked by his supervisor if he would be okay with working with a gay male before the person was interviewed. Is this even legal? She basically outed the potential employee in the workplace. If the person she asked did have a problem working with someone who's gay, it implies the man wouldn't have been hired, which would be discrimination, wouldn't it? Couldn't that lead to a possible lawsuit, or am I wrong? And Abby answers, I discussed your question with an attorney from Lambda Legal, the national organization committed to achieving full recognition of the civil rights of LGBT people. Currently, 21 states plus the District of Columbia have laws that protect gay people from employment discrimination. Wisconsin is one of them. The attorney said outing the candidate to the other employee was not necessarily illegal, but it was definitely a bad business practice. In the 21 states that offer protection for gay people, a prospective employer cannot base a hiring decision on how comfortable someone is with the candidate's sexual orientation or the perception that a coworker or customer might be uncomfortable with a gay person. That is discrimination, and it is illegal. This has been Sheila Lammers with the Vermilion County News, dated Wednesday, March 8, 2017.